That's a good one. It went quite well with the intro, I feel.
Yeah, it's got some good rhythm to it.
Okay. Trying to guess this frog. Feels like it's misty and warm. Feels misty and warm.
Okay.
Where this frog inhabits. Let's have it again.
You reckon big frog, little frog, medium frog?
Medium.
Yeah.
I think it's a medium frog.
Yeah.
And I'm looking at where we're talking about later in the episode.
Okay.
Is that a good idea or is that a bad idea?
That's a great idea, yeah.
Okay. Oh! Wait a minute. Is it the mountain chicken frog?
It's not the mountain chicken frog, no.
Wrong island. Completely wrong place, blatantly.
Yes. mountain chicken frog does not live what we're in the place that we're going to be talking about today.
I am notorious at mixing up my islands, to be fair. Yeah, completely different. Okay, the Galapagos bullfrog.
Ah, a native to the Galapagos, you would say. An amphibian native to the Galapagos. That's what he's going with. A bold choice.
Are there no amphibians?
There's
on the
no
Galapagos?
Native amphibians to the Galapagos. Right.
Damn it.
I didn't know this. I went looking.
I feel like it's in the recesses of the mind somewhere, but it's
right.
Not like the sort of
it's too salty
available.
For them.
That's mad.
Yeah. However, that doesn't mean that there's no amphibians there.
So we have an introduced amphibian to the island of Galapagos.
Right. Well, at least that's what I wanted, but I couldn't find the call for that one. I found a relative of it.
All right. Okay. So it's a So the link was. It seems a bit unfair and harsh, to be honest, Ben. The link was. It's a close relative of a species which has been established as an invasive on Galapagos.
Yes.
Okay. All right. Tenuous, but.
But
I wouldn't have got it anyway, even if I'd known that.
I would have absolutely given you the point if you'd gotten half of it. So that
is it
was,
American bull? So it's not a bullfrog?
It's not a bullfrog, no. It's the Campobello snouted tree frog, or Synax crosspedospilus.
Right, okay.
It's a lovely little frog with bright red eyes. Sort of a goldeny green colour with bright red eyes. Lovely little tree frog.
What's the common name again?
Campobello snouted tree frog.
Campobello snouted tree frog.
Mm-hmm.
Wow. Catchy name.
Oh, it's a lovely little frog.
So how did it end up getting introduced?
Well, that one isn't introduced. The one that's been introduced is Fowler's snouted tree frog, which is Synax quinquefasciatus.
Right on.
Which is very similar in shape, but is browner. And it seems to have been introduced to the Galapagos in the late 90s during some sort of cargo transfer. So apparently it was a very wet El Nino year, which might have helped it out establishing. Because I was saying that basically there aren't amphibians there because of the saltiness and the lack of fresh water on the Galapagos. So potentially the wetter El Nino period gave it a little helping hand to establish itself.
So suddenly it was like soaking wet and all the little frogs were exploring new areas.
Yeah, we can make
and
this
some
work.
Of them found their way in some cargo. Okay, yeah. A new life on the Galapagos. Very cool. So I guess that's given quite a big clue to where we're going to be talking about
Galapagos,
in the rest of the episode.
Yeah.
The Galapagos. Should we move on to our paper about the Galapagos?
Let's do it.
So this is a paper by Tapa, Aguilera and Gibbs, 2023, Rewilding Giant Tortoises, Engineers Plant Communities at Local to Landscape Scales, published in Conservation Letters. So we're talking about rewilding here.
Yes.
Which, it's a bit of a vague term, but they do define it here. But yeah, some people don't like it because they, I don't know, it got a bit sort of popular, didn't it, rewilding? And I think people sort of like complain that it doesn't really mean anything.
Yeah, well, so do a lot of words.
If you say it enough times, any word becomes
well, I mean, so. Especially when it's sort of in the zeitgeist or whatever, and a lot of people are using it, if it's helping getting funding, if it's helping getting a project going, then it's going to get pushed into all sorts of places, you're going to keep pushing those boundaries to make something rewilding if it helps it get a bit of money. So, you know.
It's been bandied about, but it's been bandied about organically.
Yeah, like I don't have a particular issue with it. Like, some words are broader. If you want a more specific one, then put a prefix on rewilding.
Yeah, essentially it sort of means that it's an ecological restoration approach, right? So the idea is that you're kind of restoring natural processes to an ecosystem by reintroducing native species. So you're kind of returning these landscapes.
It doesn't have to be native species, I feel, at times. It can be analogs,
my very
right?
next point. Yeah, increasingly it's acceptable to use analogs.
Yeah.
Like, you know.
Cheetahs into North America, that sort of stuff.
Yeah, something which is like ecologically similar. Yeah, ideally. But yeah, I mean, that's an interesting point, because talking about ecological analogs being acceptable for rewilding, people are starting to see a lot of introduced species in that light as well. Like, oh, okay, well, we've got an introduced species here. Should we exterminate it at insane financial cost and it probably won't even work? Or should we just look and think about its role in the ecosystem? And actually, if it's sort of if it performs a similar function in the ecosystem as a species which either historically lived here or now, or should be here, but has recently, you know, gone extinct, then maybe it's not such a bad thing and we can have a little bit more of a complex ecosystem for having it there.
Yeah.
There's definitely a shift in that direction. But we're not talking about that. We're talking about rewilding. And yeah, like you say, basically just getting an ecologically similar animal to perform a role in an ecosystem. One of the things we do in the UK is use cattle to do this. So there's this idea that historically ecosystems in the UK would have been a lot less woodlandy than we thought. They would have actually been like quite largely grassland environments, and that would have been maintained by grazing animals. One of which we had here called the auroch, which is essentially a massive cow that went extinct. We successfully hunted that one to extinction. And so, yeah, there's some places in the UK. I'm working on a project here in the southern UK using GPS collars on cattle, actually, in the same context to try and like understand how they're behaving. Are they actually doing this role? But yeah, the idea is that animals get released, you know, start performing the roles they would have historically performed. And then we get these nice restored ecosystems. And hopefully, because they're kind of being managed by animals, they take less work from people. So there should be a suite of benefits if it's successful. And yeah, we're looking at a case study here from, as we said, the Galapagos, a species of giant tortoise, which, you know, kind of similar to a cow. It's a mega herbivore.
But I feel like reptiles are less looked at. I mean, when you hear about rewilding, you do tend to think of big mammals a lot of the time.
Yep, and I think a lot of that is because these projects take place in Europe and America,
right,
where that's kind of one of the things they mention in this, isn't it? That islands receive less attention for this, and also islands are unique in that many of them, particularly where it's hot, are dominated by reptiles instead of mammals.
Yeah.
So they kind of have this sort of dual interest, because islands are their own thing, and also,
yep,
islands are dominated by reptiles. So if you're going to try and do ecological restoration on this kind of scale, it might well be a giant reptile that you're reintroducing,
yeah,
which obviously makes it cooler. But yeah, so this study on Espanola Island in the Galapagos, and the species of tortoise is the Hood Island giant tortoise, Chelonoidis hoodensis, which is an endemic species on Hispaniola. No, Espanola.
Espanola.
Which is an endemic species, yeah, to Espanola. It's a big conservation success story, this species. So there were just 14 of them in the 1960s, and now there's about 3,000. And the authors of this paper were kind of predicting that the presence of these giant tortoises would have some effects on the vegetation that the island had in the areas that they were in. They thought it would do things like impact the establishment of woody plants, so like less woody plants.
I mean, that's a classic mega herbivore sort of thing, right? Exactly what you're describing with the aurochs and things. You've got an animal big enough to be eating sort of small sprouting woodland, so it keeps this sort of shifting mosaic of woody plants and more grassy areas, and it's much more sort of dynamic and diverse environment on the sort of landscape scale, right?
Yeah, and it's kind of good because tortoises, I don't think they really have any predators when they're adults, right? The giant tortoises.
I can't imagine something that would be able to to depredate a tortoise,
yeah,
of that,
isn't that
size.
Like, isn't that like the whole point of it?
I mean, you'd need one of those ancient swamp crocodiles, right?
Yeah, I don't think they have natural predators on Espanola. And so that is obviously kind of a good thing for these kind of restoration projects, because it's like, okay, great, we've restored the tortoise. There isn't any predators of the tortoise, but there shouldn't be.
Right, they should just balance themselves out.
Yeah.
Take care of it.
But like, here in the UK is another example, you know, if we've got a preponderance of deer, there's too many deer because we exterminated all the deer predators. So now in order to stop woodlands being chomped to bits and all the baby trees being eaten, some places you've got to control the deer. But they won't have a problem like this because the tortoises hopefully should just reach carrying capacity and then stop.
And I would imagine also exclusion fencing probably is easier for a giant tortoise than it is for,
yeah,
for deer. Because I can't imagine these tortoises can jump particularly high.
They can probably dig. I don't know if
they can probably dig. But they'd have to dig a big old
true.
Hole.
I actually don't think they do dig.
I mean, there's chasm under the fence. I can imagine them just powering through a fence with just raw strength.
Did you see the fences, the pictures of the fences in the paper? They're pretty
I
pathetic.
Didn't. No,
spot
I missed
on,
that.
Mate. It looks like...
Oh, it's just mesh.
Yeah, it's a low mesh. So I don't think they're that good at powering through stuff. I think you've over-egged it.
Nah.
Yeah.
Nah, that's...
Think about those legs.
Maybe they just discouraged and they don't try very hard.
I feel like
just to demotivate them.
Yeah, but why would you bother if there's, you know... Unless there's something in behind those fences they really want. But also, I think you're overestimating how much traction a giant tortoise can get. I feel like most of that strength must be in just holding up the bulk, right? Like, they're just sort of...
That's true, yeah.
I feel like they're balancing and, like, doddering forwards. But maybe that's not fair.
Maybe if they were going downhill, they could take out a fence. if they just gathered a lot of momentum.
Tuck the legs in.
Yeah.
I don't think they do that, though. I don't think they use their body as a boulder. I don't think that's something they've evolved to. Maybe, though.
These are the ones that quite have the pronounced... Oh, my gosh, I don't even know what you'd call
it. Yeah, the bit...
opening on the front so they can reach higher vegetation.
What about it?
So I feel like they wouldn't boulder down a hill very well.
Oh no, yeah, they wouldn't be very streamlined. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah, so they excluded tortoises from a bunch of areas and then they compared the vegetation between the areas, and they did this locally and at the landscape scale, so they were looking at sort of like local effects and also large scale effects. And yeah, the tortoises smashed it, really, didn't they? They kept the cactuses at bay. The cacti were kept at bay. They kept the woody plants down and they promoted grasses. So the cacti, they dropped these little mini versions of themselves to reproduce asexually. But the tortoises just munched them all. So the tortoises were pleased with that. They enjoyed that. So they halt asexual reproduction. So it seems like tortoises are not necessarily great for the cacti. But what's interesting is the relationship doesn't end there, because not only do they eat the asexual little buds that the cacti drop when they're trying to reproduce, so they foil that attempt at reproduction. But what they do, which is doing the cacti a favor, is when the cacti drop their fruits, the tortoises will come along and eat the fruits and then they'll disperse the seeds. So it's quite a nice little symbiosis between the tortoises and the cacti.
Yeah, that's sort of, it's suppressing the asexual reproduction of the cacti, but promoting the sort of sexual reproduction of the cacti. Yeah. Which strikes me as being better in general, right? For like genetic diversity of that cactus and therefore its resistance to any sort of weird future pressure. If you've got that diversity, they tend to be more resilient to things.
Yeah. You wonder if now that the tortoises are back, the cacti will stop doing that so much.
Maybe. Or maybe it's part of the cacti game to encourage a tortoise close.
Ah.
So it will also eat the fruit.
Further offerings.
Yeah.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
That's cool. So, the tortoises have done it. They've done it. They've engineered the savanna-type ecosystem that would have likely existed on the island before we virtually exterminated the tortoises. And because this is what the ecosystem would have previously been more similar to, the expectation of conservationists and kind of the whole idea behind rewilding is that lots of other species will benefit from having their food sources or other species with which they interact restored to their former glory. One thing which is super cool, which they mentioned in the paper here, is that Espanola Island is effectively the only nesting area on the entire planet of this species of albatross called the waved albatross. It appears that this species basically relies on tortoises to maintain areas that are free of woody plants because they need large areas to take off and land, which is pretty cool. So because the tortoises are clearing out the woody vegetation, it likely allows landing strips for albatross. And that's just one example of the kind of benefits that these things can bring if you reintroduce them.
Wow, that's kind of a massive deal.
Yeah, I knew you'd like that.
I think that's why rewilding just sort of makes so much sense, is fix one aspect and it should spiral in and sort of restore a lot of others. And with no potentially no direct intervention with helping the albatross, right? Mm-hmm. Like, help the tortoises will do the work. Don't worry
you
about it.
You want to conserve albatross, all you've got to do is slingshot some tortoises onto the island.
Yes, many of them.
Many of them. Or just let
3,000.
Yeah, let them breed and do it themselves.
Yeah. Don't even have to pay them.
Tortoises will just sort it. So there we go. Yeah. I didn't get to the bottom of why the tortoise common name is the Hood Island giant tortoise. Is Hood Island the former name of Espanola?
Or is it the name of a group of islands and one of them is called... Let's have a look here. I think it's a different name for the same island.
Oh, is it?
Oh my God, it's also been called King Charles Island at one point and then renamed to Hood Island. Okay, so yes, they're all the same island. Yes.
Oh yeah, yeah, it's just another name for Espanola Island. Well, there we go. Should probably start calling it the Espanola Island Tortoise, right?
Probably. Probably.
Yeah. But there we go. Excellent example of a rewilding project using a really cool giant mega herbivore, the Espanola Tortoise, to, massively impact vegetation communities and like fundamentally change the appearance and ecosystem on the island. Pretty cool. Pretty good success story.
Exceptionally cool.
Really nice story.
Yeah.
I really like the title as well. They had the title spot on. Rewilding giant tortoises, engineers, plant communities at local to landscape scales. It just sounds punchy. So have you got any other business this episode?
I do. I have some tortoise business.
Ooh, excellent.
I have tortoises have smarter brains than you think they might have.
Well, that's impossible business. Because I cannot overestimate tortoises. They're the best.
Ah.
No, go on.
So, cross-modal association between visual and acoustic cues in a tortoise. Testudo Hermanni, or Hermanni.
Herman's tortoise.
So Herman's tortoise. It's a wonderful little paper here about teaching tortoises to associate sound with getting some food. And once they've learnt, okay, sound means where food is, you put them in a new environment with two different sounds. One is high-pitched, one is low-pitched. And you have different sized colored discs with each of these sounds. And the food is placed where the disc size, so you've got a small disc goes with high-pitched sound, large disc goes with low-pitched sound. The tortoise is not trained to know high-pitched goes with low, with small, and low-pitched goes with large, but they will naturally sort of go towards the one that has the size matching the sound. So there's this, they have this natural inclination to associate a low-pitched sound with a larger shape size. And when there's a high-pitched sound played, they tend to go towards the smaller shape.
Why?
Why? It's just one of these core associations that apparently pops up in loads of... I mean, we have that, right? If you hear a high-pitched sound, you're more likely to think it comes from a small...
mosquito.
Yeah, right? We've done it with the frogs, too. We hear a frog call at the beginning of an episode, and you immediately get a sense of whether it's a small frog or a big frog. And when it's a big frog making a really high-pitched sound, it's surprising and weird, and we make fun of it.
That's true. That's true.
Yeah. Mm. But tortoises have the same... I don't know if I explained the experiment particularly well, but the crux of it is that they have this same association between high-pitched and small and low-pitched and large.
The thing that I find weird about that is if they hear a low-pitched sound and they associate it with a large thing, why are they inclined to go towards it? Surely it'd be like, oh my God, there's a low-pitched thing. It's scary.
Well, because they were trained that the sound meant food.
Oh, I see. Okay. So they already have the expectation of sound and food, but they go towards the larger thing because it might be related.
Of sound makes food. And then when they're played two competing sounds in two directions, okay, the only thing differentiating them is the size. So they go for the one that is more congruent with the sound.
I see. Yeah? I understand the experiment now. Wow. So yeah, they hear the sound and they just assume it's coming from the big thing, not the small thing. That's kind of crazy, actually, when you think about that, because that is the same decision that we'd probably make.
Absolutely. Wow. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. We have tortoise brains.
I love people. People come up with this stuff. It's so clever. Like the idea that you could just even test that is really like.
It's great. Proper left field. Great. Yeah, it's a wonderful little paper.
Yeah, and tortoises have that other thing.
Really worth checking out.
They have that other thing where they go towards faces, right? They like ovals as well. We had a paper about that ages ago.
Yeah, there was something like that. Yeah, there was some like association with faces, wasn't there? Yeah.
So if you, that's just, yeah, they can discriminate. They've got some crazy stuff going on, tortoises. I feel like if you gave them long enough, tortoises would have evolved to be the intellectual complex social being on Earth. No, they had their chance. They had their chance.
Maybe. I don't know. I think doing that requires a certain level of like discontent.
I think tortoises are just too chill.
Yeah, they've got it.
They're
made.
They're fine with
mate.
It, aren't they? Yeah.
Yeah.
I love it. Giant tortoises.
Anyway, I'll put the paper in the show notes so people can look at it in more detail if they care about it.
Cool.
It's intriguing.
Nice. Cool.
And I love these things that draw connections between the perceptions of animal and the perceptions of us, because that's a very... You can picture that, right?
Yeah, I mean,
you can picture a small thing making high-pitched sound. It's like, yeah, tortoise sees it in the same way.
Just imagining the tortoise hearing that sound, looking around and being like, oh, yeah, I'll be that, yeah.
It's a little eyes.
Yeah, I'll be that for sure. It's bigger. Crazy. Oh, wow. Cool. All right. Any further business for this episode?
Nah, just tortoise stuff, mate.
Yeah, no, just pure tortoise episode, which is kind of long overdue. Tortoises are always fun to cover. We veto a few papers which are just too bleak about tortoises and turtles, don't we? Where it's just like absolutely like mass death. So it's nice to have a good conservation success story. This is what it's all about. Yeah. But if you want to get in touch with us, you can. If you've got any corrections or questions, herphighlights@gmail.com. We are on social media. If you want to support the podcast, you can. patreon.com/herphighlights. Thanks again to all the patrons. I think that's about it. So thank you for listening.
Yeah, thanks for listening.